This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Do you remember the last live event you attended before the pandemic? Was it a game, a concert, a theater performance? For me, it was a Brittany Howard concert. So good. The audience was in it, the band was amazing, and Brittany put on a show. Whenever I was feeling the disconnection of the pandemic, I'd go back to that moment when I was singing along badly in a crowd with Brittany on stage. Today, a few of us are trickling back into stadiums and arenas. Bruce Springsteen just kicked off a series of shows on Broadway with one new wrinkle. You need proof of full vaccination to get in. But in one sense, this year will be a lot like years past. Getting your hands on tickets for your favorite shows and games might mean paying dearly for them. This issue, how much tickets cost and who's actually making money off them, it caught the attention of Byard Duncan, my buddy here at Reveal a couple years ago. He had an experience of buying NBA tickets that left him scratching his head.
It was my best friend's birthday. He's a Philadelphia 76ers fan. And I decided I wanted to surprise him with Sixers tickets. They were playing the Sacramento Kings, which is not so far from Oakland here where I live.
This was January 2019. Byard Googles Kings Sixers tickets and eventually gets directed to a website called Ticket Network.
The tickets were pretty close to the floor. They were reasonably priced too, since the Kings haven't been good in more than a decade. So I was looking at the layout of the Kings arena and I selected two seats.
Byard checks out and the money leaves his bank account. Good to go, right? Well, not so fast. A couple weeks later, before leaving the Reveal office on a Friday night, he looks up his email confirmation and notices something strange. It doesn't actually include any tickets.
It just said, quote, "Get excited. We've received your order and you're on your way. We'll contact you soon with more details on how you'll get your tickets." But it was the night before the game, and I didn't have any more details about where I could get my tickets.
So he calls Ticket Network's customer service number.
And the guy on the other end took a minute and he looked for the tickets and came back and said, "These tickets aren't available." And I was like, "Wait a minute, how is that possible?"
Remember, Byard has already paid for these tickets. He gets put on hold. After a while, the customer service rep comes back on the line and says, "Good news. He can get comparable tickets," and he proposes a new section. But Byard has the seating map of the arena pulled up, and he notices,
but that section's way farther away than the tickets I thought I had bought. And so I ask him, "Okay, those tickets are farther away. What do they cost?" And he tells me, they're the same price as the tickets you bought. And at this point, I'm like, well, isn't that awfully convenient for you? That they're the same price and they're worse tickets. So here's where I'm beginning to get really angry. There are like two sides to me. One is investigative reporter, curious, patient, and methodical. The other side, though, is a rabid NBA fan, so angry sometimes. And I have to say I was experiencing both of these things in this moment. And unfortunately, both sides involve a lot of swearing, too.
Byard gets put on hold again. But this time, he starts digging. He heads over to Pacer, a big database of federal court records.
I go on Pacer and look up Ticket Network, and I immediately find the complaint for a lawsuit that's actually going on while I'm having this conversation with customer service. It's from the New York Attorney General's office.
It turns out The New York's top lawyer had recently accused Ticket Network of engaging in what was described as a massive scheme to trick tens of thousands of unsuspecting consumers into buying tickets that the sellers did not actually have. It begins to sink in for Byard that he might be one of them. After more time on hold and some arguing, he makes Ticket Network agree to give him his money back. Then he gets real tickets the day of the game directly from the Sacramento Kings website. When a reporter has a bad experience, sometimes it turns into an opportunity to start digging. So that's exactly what Byard did. And what he found inspired this week's show, which we first aired earlier this year.
After my experience with Ticket Network, I thought, okay, if I really want to understand what just happened here, I need to start by casting a pretty wide net. So I sent public records requests for 10 years' worth of complaints to every state attorney general's office in the country and to the Federal Trade Commission. The complaints I got back weren't just about Ticket Network. They described all sorts of problems with the industry's major players: StubHub, Vivid Seats, and Ticketmaster, too. One complaint that caught my eye was from Sharon Valentine. She fell into several traps.
I am retired with my husband in Wilmington, North Carolina. I have a checkered background.
She means like an eclectic background, not like she killed a guy.
I have been everything from a teacher in Thailand and in Taiwan to doing Defense Department meeting planning, technical meeting planning, and ended my career as a farmer and managing a nonprofit.
Sharon and her husband are major supporters of the arts, too. Opera, museums, historical events, live theater. She calls this stuff the bread of life. She missed it a lot in 2020.
Mingle with others, listen to good music, go to a good play, even to the movies.
Back in 2019, a couple months after my own experience, Sharon saw a mention in her local paper of a production of Something Rotten. It's a Broadway musical about two brothers in the theater business in the 1500s who were in competition with William Shakespeare.
Hello, Will. I knew you wouldn't go down without a fight.
The Thompson, thou surely doth.
Sharon said she followed the web address on the ad. She landed on a website she thought was the official box office for the Wilson Center, a theater at nearby Cape Fear Community College. It had ticket listings, a seating chart, and directions. Pretty quickly, though, things started to feel a little off. For starters, she said, the website couldn't provide her with actual seat numbers. And right at the end of the transaction process, her total for two tickets skyrocketed to $481.93. But since she assumed she was on the official site, she pulled the trigger anyway. She later discovered she could have gotten them directly from the Wilson Center for a total of just $170. Oh, and just like me, after the money left her account, she didn't even have the tickets she wanted yet. Instead, when she called customer service for answers, a representative told her basically, sit tight, we're working on it.
He said that they would email me the tickets. I said, all right, go ahead, I would like them right away. And he said, no, I can't do that.
One reason he couldn't do that? He didn't actually work for the venue itself. Without realizing, Sharon had landed on what's called a secondary ticket market, a website where tickets get resold. She was confused and furious and didn't want these overpriced tickets. She blurted out, well, what do you suggest I do?
And he said, oh, we have a great answer for you for that. You go out and sell them on the secondary market.
Sell what exactly? She didn't even have the tickets yet.
I thought, whoa, this is really a scam.
After Sharon hung up the phone, she decided to report this website to North Carolina's attorney general. The URL was boxoffice-tickets.com.
Do you remember JFK's old adage? Don't get mad, get even.
The company affiliated with the website was the same one I dealt with, Ticket Network. And although Sharon was ready to get even, they seemed prepared. A few days after Sharon filed her complaint, Ticket Network's legal team sent a response to the AG. It was a point-by-point dissection of all the things she should have noticed about the site. She should have seen the tiny disclosure on their homepage that this was a resale marketplace where prices may be above the venue's price. She should have noticed that her tickets had a so-called delivery date when they would hopefully arrive. Finally, she should have realized the site, quote, does not act as a primary sale box office, even though, you know, it's called boxoffice-tickets.com. Ticket Network declared no refund is due from the seller.
I will tell you, I was ballistic. I had obviously been scammed. And I thought, you know, this has got to affect other people too. I can't be the first one.
Sharon is definitely not the first one to fall into what I've come to call the ticket trap. I've read thousands of pages of complaints from all kinds of people. Folks trying to go to music festivals and sports fanatics who have lots of experience buying tickets. They describe a sort of obstacle course of tricks and deceptions that major players in the secondary market have perfected over the years. Ticket Network, for its part, maintains that it helps create a competitive marketplace where more inventory drives prices down. We're going to break down how it works step by step, beginning with the website she thought was official.
My name is John Brayo. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy, Telecommunications, and Fraud at the National Consumers League.
I called up John to talk about these so-called white label websites, like the one Sharon stumbled onto. Regulators and ticket buyers say they're designed to deceive people into believing they're on an actual box office site. The sites look official. Sometimes they'll have the venue's name in their web address, or pictures of a marquee, or a section about the place's history. Back in 2014, Ticket Network and its business partners settled a lawsuit with the state of Connecticut and the FTC over these kinds of sites. As part of the discovery process, Ticket Network was forced to hand over a list of all the web domains they'd registered. That document is 74 pages long. It includes addresses like chittychittybangbangonbroadway.com, jerryseinfeldtickets.com, chicagowhitesoxtickets.org. Anyway, a list of 4,234 URLs, all registered by Ticket Network.
As long as there's money to be made scalping tickets, as long as there's money to be made through these white label sites, the operators of them are going to get creative to try and really operate in the margins of what can be considered acceptable.
As part of the settlement, the FTC forbade ticket resellers from using the word official in most ads, websites, and URLs. It also said resellers could not misrepresent directly or by implication that a resale ticket site is an actual venue site. But consumer advocates like John are quick to point out that there's a lot of wiggle room left for secondary sellers to operate.
If I'm selling Yankees tickets, for example, and my background on my website is pinstripes, that may not necessarily be illegal under the terms of the consent order, but certainly I would think it denotes some kind of affiliation with the New York Yankees.
I found that white label sites have persisted for years since the FTC handed down its restrictions. Turns out, it's easy for consumers to feel duped, even while the sites insist they're following the government's rules. Like that site where Sharon Valentine landed when she wanted to see something rotten. She said it had her fooled from the very beginning.
The advertising that was done, although the word official was not used, made it seem like it was official. So rather than go in and research another site, I thought I was going into an official website for the Wilson Center.
One of the most striking things I learned about these sites is that white labels had an average markup of roughly 180% over what you'd pay at the venue. That's according to a study from the Government Accountability Office. By comparison, resale sites that don't impersonate venues, their markup was usually about 74%. So, in other words, the sneakiest sites had the biggest gouge. So, Sharon, like many others, tumbled into the ticket trap. First, she was directed to a secondary site when all she really wanted to do was find the actual venue. Next up, the murkiness around what she'd actually end up paying.
I'm particularly concerned by the hidden fees that the ticketing industry charges American consumers at the very end of the purchase process.
This issue of hidden fees is such a big deal, the government has regulated it in other industries, like airlines. And in February of 2020, the House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce talked about it at this hearing on ticketing.
Democrat Frank Pallone of New Jersey was the chair.
And we're all familiar with this. You search for a ticket online and one price is initially displayed. But when you go to check out, hefty fees are added and the final price is much higher than the original price shown.
Remember, right at the tail end of her transaction, Sharon saw her total balloon to $481.93 for two tickets she later found out were worth $170. At one point in the hearing, three of the industry's major players, Ticket Network, Vivid Seats, and StubHub, are asked how exactly they come up with fees. First to answer is Ticket Network's CEO, Don Vaccaro.
On the sites that we control, we determine fees by what the others in the marketplace are charging.
Vivid Seats.
It's market competition, so it's subject to discipline by the market. If there's a lower price, we have to match it.
StubHub.
Because we're a marketplace, the sellers determine the price of the tickets.
If your fee's too high, people are going to use your site. Is that kind of the market determines, Mr. Perez?
So these companies are all basically locked into a game of chicken with each other. The main thing that really dictates where they set their fees and how they apply them is what the other guy is doing. Buyers tend to make decisions based on advertised prices, which are often already inflated. Then last-minute fees get stacked on top of that. One consumer summed this up perfectly. Quote, "I've never gone grocery shopping and been hit with a soup packaging fee after scanning my Campbell's cans." I went back to Sharon again with all of this.
Incredible. They don't have any way to credibly tell the consumer what that fee is. It is suddenly slapped on as you check out.
Okay, the last step in the trap, it's maybe the wildest one. Remember, Sharon paid for tickets, but when she asked Ticket Network to email them to her, they couldn't do it. Something similar happened to me. The night before that NBA game, I hadn't gotten my tickets either. Just a promise that they'd arrive eventually. These are signs that what we both bought were so-called speculative tickets. Tickets that brokers don't even have in the first place. Instead, they advertise seats at dramatically marked up prices, try to buy the actual tickets later, and keep the difference. For really popular events, though, sometimes brokers can't even get tickets, so they back out on their sales. Ahead of the 2015 Super Bowl, some people who'd bought airfare and booked hotels learned too late that the tickets they thought they had didn't even exist. This Seattle Seahawks fan was in tears.
For 2 weeks, I thought for sure I was going to be in there, and I don't get to do that. It's tough. It's upsetting that you could just, sorry, we don't have your tickets anymore.
The FTC tried to crack down on this, too, sending out a warning letter to secondary market sites in 2010, demanding they make it obvious when tickets are speculative. But that fine print can be easy to miss. In 2016, a Billy Joel fan in New York complained about seeing marked up tickets on StubHub before they were officially on sale. And in June of 2019, consumers in Rhode Island were misled into buying speculative Hamilton tickets. When they arrived at the theater, they learned they'd paid five times as much as some of the people sitting next to them. Many people, like Sharon and me, don't realize that what we're actually buying from these sites is just a promise that someone is going to try to get tickets for us. And it's not just ticket buyers who lose out either.
I'm Christy Grantham, the director of ticketing at the Wilson Center in Wilmington, North Carolina, and we seat about 1,500 people.
You could say that Christy is the person Sharon Valentine wishes she'd reached from the very beginning. Someone who actually would have sold her Something Rotten tickets directly. For years, Christy has seen up close the tactics that secondary sellers use.
They're selling tickets on row Y, and I'm looking at my chart, and no one's bought any tickets on row Y. They have no tickets to sell, and they're selling them for $234, and I'm selling them for $30.
Again, that's $30 from the venue and $234 on the secondary market for tickets they haven't even bought from Christy yet. Okay, but so what about when they do buy them from her and sell them at a higher price? She's still filling up the house, right? So, like, why does she care?
I care a lot, and for a lot of reasons. I don't want someone to spend their entire entertainment budget on one event that they really want to go to, when they could come to five events, including that one that they really want to come to, and they can have so many more wonderful experiences in my venue.
Except they get caught in the ticket trap. I should note here that Sharon did, in fact, get tickets to Something Rotten. many folks who buy speculative tickets do end up with seats somewhere. But in Sharon's case, she says they weren't the ones she thought she'd paid for. She told the state attorney general that she felt misled by Ticket Network. But I think the more important point here is how simple it all could have been. Sharon wanted to see a show. Christy was there, about 9 miles from Sharon's home, waiting to sell her tickets at a fair price. But secondary sellers like Ticket Network were able to swoop in, make lots of money, and leave both of them frustrated.
This particular company could put Bernie Madoff to shame. I mean, it was so beautifully organized.
After figuring out the machinery of the ticket trap, Byard wanted to talk to the people pulling its levers. What they had to say, next on Reveal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're talking about the secondary ticket market, where sports fans and concert goers sometimes feel ripped off. This has been going on for a long time. Even in the 1800s, speculators were jacking up ticket prices for readings by Charles Dickens and P.T. Barnum's circus. And for just as long, people have been trying to bring it under control. Here's Reveal's Byard Duncan again.
This whole regulatory fight has been like a centuries-long cat-and-mouse game. These days, it plays out in the halls of Washington.
I sort of wanted to share an experience that may have happened to me.
This is Devin Willis. It's June of 2019 when she was an attorney at the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection. She's moderating a panel about deceptive practices within the world of online ticket sales. She talks about trying to buy tickets to Hamilton at a Philadelphia venue called the Forest Theater. She does a Google search.
And it takes me to this landing page. It shows Philadelphia Theater. It has the theater name underneath it, Forest Theater.
You know the drill by now. The tickets she sees are listed for $469 a piece. Worth it, she thinks, for Hamilton on opening night.
How the play was. So I must be at the right place.
She's not. The actual tickets, she learns later that they're not even on sale yet.
Like, am I crazy? Like, so I am now frantic. I go back and I'm trying to see, well, what did I buy and who did I buy it from?
The point here is that even the people in charge of enforcing the rules around ticketing, they're liable to get confused too. Today, there's this big cluster of federal, state, and local regulations all cross-hatching the U.S. They can be easy to get around. The rules vary by jurisdiction. For example, ticket resale laws are incredibly strict in Arkansas, but brokers who live out of state still sell there. Federal regulators may make an example out of a company here and there, but it's up to the states to really crack down. And they don't always do that. I really wanted to talk to someone behind one of those companies. This is Don Vaccaro.
Hi, is this Byard?
This is Byard, yeah. Is this Don?
Yeah, Byard. I'm sorry, I apologize. Byard. Very simple to pronounce.
Don is the CEO of Ticket Network, the company affiliated with the sites where Sharon and I ended up. He founded it in 2002, but he first got into reselling tickets in the late 1970s.
I went down to Madison Square Garden to buy some tickets for some friends to go to a concert.
When he arrived, he noticed that the Garden had just kicked off another sale for the rock band Jethro Tull. This was pre-internet, of course, so word hadn't really gotten out yet. Don saw an opportunity.
And I was actually able to get some great seats for that show and able to go back and sell them, make a profit.
This is what people used to just call scalping. Things took off from there. First, Don set up his own brokerage. Then he got into software. Today, this whole business has largely moved online and become much more regulated than the guy in a trench coat on a street corner days. Ticket Network became one of the largest secondary sellers in the U.S. In normal years, there's more than $5.5 billion of tickets listed on their exchange. The first thing I wanted to ask Don is, how does Ticket Network actually help fans?
When you add to the supply of tickets, the equilibrium price goes down. Okay? It's true in every marketplace.
Don views primary ticket sellers like the behemoth Ticketmaster as these monopolistic bad guys. He says what he's doing is giving fans options, more places to buy tickets. But here's the thing. There's a key ingredient here that economists say is missing. Transparency. On sites like the one Sharon visited, people think they're at the venue's box office. And they think they're seeing the face value price. They also don't expect huge fees right at the finish line. People don't even realize they could be comparison shopping. In the thousands of pages of complaints I read about the market's major players, it was often the same story. Consumers felt deceived, manipulated, ripped off. And according to a former New York Attorney General, there's evidence that's by design. When the state's top lawyer sued Ticket Network back in 2018, the company had to hand over a bunch of internal documents. One of them was about their speculative listings. That's when brokers sell tickets they don't actually have in hand yet. Ticket Network admitted these listings, quote, create the appearance of plentiful inventory on the exchange when there are little or no real tickets. I'm wondering, Don, in your view, do you think consumers would willingly buy speculative tickets if they understood what they were buying were speculative tickets?
Here's what I'd like to say to that is when you go to a hotel and you book a room in a hotel, do you think you're booking the actual room that's available? You're not. You're booking from a...
This is what it was like to try to get answers out of Don. He would change the subject or answer my question with another question. He even flat out denied that his company has received complaints recently.
Usually, I don't think we've had a complaint in the longest time from anyone.
This is just not true. On top of complaints like Sharon's that I got through records requests, others about Ticket Network are easy to find. They're on the Better Business Bureau, Yelp, Twitter. But Don says Ticket Network is not the problem. He points his finger again at the big primary sellers like Ticketmaster. He says customers are worried about being able to transfer tickets to someone else.
And they're concerned about the data that they give up and that they share when they're buying a primary ticket or they're transferring a primary ticket.
This is not what fans mentioned in the complaints I read. Almost all of them were worried about getting deceived and gouged by companies like Don's. Although Don did admit,
look, we're not perfect. No one's perfect. We're here to make our site's better. We can always do better.
One of the people in charge of making Don's company do better is Rebecca Kelly Slaughter.
I think having competition in the ticket marketplace is great at every level, but I don't think there's any justification for companies to misrepresent who they are as sellers.
Rebecca's a commissioner at the FTC. She specializes in consumer protection and competition. Remember that the FTC cracked down on Ticket Network and two of its website partners for profiting from deceptive mimicking tactics. The three had to pay $1.4 million to the state of Connecticut, where Ticket Network is based. Despite that crackdown, though, sites like these are still all over the place. And I wanted Rebecca's take on some examples I found. Here, I'm going to share my screen. The official site for this is jonesbeach.com, which you can see. I show her two sites, a venue's official site, then a secondary site with a lot of similarities. It's really easy to confuse the two. You can see they have a little seahorse. They have a picture of the venue. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how it seems possible to conduct business like this while playing by the FTC's rules.
I'm not going to say that conducting businesses like this does play by the FTC's rules. And to be clear, the rules of the FTC are the laws of the United States.
By Rebecca's own admission, this site very well could be operating illegally. So I ask her, why is it so hard to rein this stuff in?
There are a lot of violations out there to investigate and pursue, and our resources don't even come close to allowing us to do that. The FTC had more, 50% more, 50% more full-time employees at the beginning of the Reagan administration than it does today. Our workload has increased astronomically in the intervening 40 years.
Congress has been trying to give the FTC more tools. In 2016, it passed legislation to stop the use of bots that vacuum up thousands of tickets in minutes. But nobody enforced it until this January. There's also proposed legislation, something called the BOSS Act, which aims to further tighten restrictions on white label websites, the ones that often look like venue websites but aren't.
I mean, I will seek in my mind for a good faith argument for why they are good for consumers, and I can't find one.
Also, it would curb the practice of selling tickets you don't even have yet.
This has been the topic of enforcement attention for a decade, and the problem is still there, so it is clear that more needs to happen.
Under President Biden, Slaughter anticipates more momentum at the FTC around consumer protection issues like ticketing.
It's an area that we know Congress cares about, we know the American public cares about, and we need to continue to care about.
Until then, fans will have to protect themselves. I learned the most important thing you can do is scrutinize the website before you buy your tickets. Read the fine print and look for phrases like resale marketplace or prices may be above or below face value. If you really want to be certain you're buying from the venue, consider picking up the phone and just giving them a call. And hey, if the show is legitimately sold out, but tickets are available at a premium on the secondary market, to a certain extent, that's just supply and demand in action. Maybe it's out of reach, or maybe it's worth it to you, especially after a whole year without live events.
That was Reveal's Byard Duncan, who plans to see his beloved Golden State Warriors in person as soon as they start playing again this fall. Our story was produced by Catherine Miskowski, who can't wait to take her daughters to see Weird Al Yankovic. I'll be tagging along with both of them. Since this story first aired, Byard has written an in-depth guide to help fans like you avoid deceptive practices when buying tickets. To read it, text TRAP to 474747. You can text STOP at any time, and standard data rates apply. Again, that's TRAP to 474747. Reveal's Ike Srikandaraja is looking forward to seeing Friday Night Classic movies and concerts at his favorite theater here in Oakland. They're still closed up, but he dropped by to ask when we might be able to go back and what it'll be like when we do.
Hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice
come on
to
in.
Meet you.
I met Leslie.
Leslie Stewart, general manager at the Paramount Theater in Oakland, California.
Hey, thanks.
Jason.
And Jason.
Jason Blackwell. Assistant General Manager.
I usually shake hands, but we won't do that anymore.
They let me do something I've been wanting to do since the pandemic began. Be inside a theater. But not just any theater.
A new era in motion picture history was ushered in with the gala opening of the magnificent $3 million Paramount Theater.
Coming into the Paramount Theater, you're walking into 1931.
Jason heads through the dark lobby for the switch box.
So here we go.
Soft amber light starts to fill the room, and you can see on the walls these golden maidens. They look like they're just waking up, and it all feels like sunrise.
I can't tell you how happy that just made me.
Oh, all the lights coming on? Yeah, it's fun.
It's as elegant as the Empire State Building, with a concession stand.
There are many superlatives which apply to the Paramount.
For 90 years, this landmark theater has hosted movie premieres, later concerts, lectures, even naturalization ceremonies. But since the coronavirus...
Our last show was Buddy Guy and Friends, March the 3rd, 2020.
Yeah, that was the last time we had anyone in the building.
The poster for a canceled jazz show from March 11th of last year still hangs in the lobby.
Honestly, I thought we'd be closed for a month, maybe a few weeks, maybe May. Never thought that we would be in this situation.
At first, they explored the idea of roping off 6 feet between seats. But that reduced their 3,000-person theater to 450. That small an audience wouldn't cover the costs. So they rescheduled all of their events from last spring to the fall, then to early 2021. And now...
I'm actually now rescheduling the rescheduling events to 2022.
Baby Shark, the live show, has been rescheduled now 4 times.
Poor Baby Shark. He's just swimming from month to month. It's very sad.
It is sad. In the meantime, the Paramount secured a federal PPP loan for about $250,000. But they've still had to let staff go. The Paramount and 1,100 other venues are looking to their trade group for guidance from the likes of Russ Simons.
I'm a part of the International Association of Venue Managers, and I lead that group's COVID-19 industry response.
The group put out a detailed and wide-ranging guide to safe reopening. Not an easy task, given that the concerns of the Paramount are very different from the Superdome or from a venue in Arkansas where local health rules have allowed for indoor concerts since May. Generally speaking, though, here's what many Americans might expect when we do take our seats. The first is a lesson the industry learned after 9/11. Before the attack, event staff tried to mostly be invisible.
But following the security issues and 9/11, what we learned was is the public is desirous of a visible and obvious presence.
Back then, the Paramount printed the word security on their cruise jackets. Audience members saw security everywhere. This time, the audience will see janitors everywhere. Concessions will work differently, too. Instead of waiting in line, you may be ordering on your phone, then picking up at a window. And Russ says there'll be fewer choices.
The truth of the matter is we probably had too many menu items by a good 60%, and if we were having a genuinely honest conversation, perhaps 80%.
Goodbye, soft pretzel. Next, and this is probably the most important, venues will ask about your health records.
I think you probably see a hybrid where some zones of the building or sections or levels may be vaccine-oriented.
And the venues, they're going to have to figure out how to pay for it. All of this will take time.
I don't see this being a successful endeavor in the next 3 to 6 months, but I believe that the work that's being done in the next 3 to 6 months could make the second half of this year a lot more entertaining for your listeners.
It's not looking great for summer blockbusters, but come Nutcracker season...
Yeah, I feel pretty good about the Nutcracker this December. I do.
If that happens, I hope I get to see it in my favorite theater.
That was Reveal's Ike Srikandarajah. The Paramount Theater will be reopening on August 7th with comedian Franco Escamilla. The Oakland Ballet is scheduled to perform the Nutcracker there in December. The pandemic shut down concerts and plays all over the world, including K-pop concerts. A few moved online. In fact, one sold more than 700,000 tickets. In a moment, what one fan discovered after she got a rare close-up look inside the world of K-pop. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. It's not just fans in the U.S. who are anxious for sports events and concerts to open up again. It's K-pop fans all over the world. South Korean boy band BTS is one of the most well-known K-pop groups in the U.S. Fans copy their dance moves, buy their clothes, and hang on their every tweet. K-pop has become a culture of its own, and it's a huge international business. And when money's involved, things can get
complicated. Yoo Hyung Jung is a data journalist who first followed K-pop as a fan. Then she got a rare look at the business side. We first aired this story about her experience earlier this year.
K-pop gives me an odd sense of pride. When I see BTS, I feel like they're beautiful national treasures, and I'm like a sloppy, broke journalist in the US. But hey, we're the same. I was born in Korea, but spent half my life here and in Canada, and K-pop is one of those things that has kept me connected to my roots. When I was in the fifth grade, I was going to school in Vancouver, and my parents used to send me CDs of this boy band called G.O.D. I swear I went to bed with that CD. And then later, when I lived in Arizona, I really liked this other group called Super Junior. But in 2017 is when I fell hard. Really, really hard. In the spring of that year, I started watching a South Korean reality TV show called Produce 101. It was a cutthroat competition-style show where week by week, viewers would vote for their favorite contestants out of 101 boys. That's why it's called Produce 101. And at the end of the season, the top 11 would become a boy band called 101. That's W-A-N-N-A-1. Something about voting for someone every week and watching them get so emotional over whether they were going to make it made me feel like I was responsible for their success. People were literally campaigning for their picks, like they would for political candidates. This contestant is thanking his supporters for voting for him. And when the contestant I was rooting for got picked in the end, I felt like I had a hand in it. None of this would be fun without other people, and it's so easy to bond with others who love the same thing as you do. There are massive networks of communities surrounding K-pop. To me, the fandom was like a doorway to Korea. Every time I checked out of real life and went online to see what was going on there, I would be tuning into Korean culture and talking about Korean things. Mostly, I was just so excited to speak Korean again. I really crossed the point of no return when I went to see 101 perform in person. In the summer of 2017, Produce 101 had ended, and the 11 boys selected from the show were finally going to make their debut. And it turned out that the band's first public appearance was going to be in the U.S. at a K-pop convention in Los Angeles called KCON. Obviously, it was fate. There was absolutely no way I wasn't going. KCON was awesome. 101 was awesome. I was having a great time. But then there were also moments when I was starting to feel like, wait a minute, this is kind of shady. Every single thing was commodified to the max. K-pop has figured out this formula for making money, and it's been chemically engineered to make you crave more and more, like fast food. Everything is for sale. Music, merchandise, even an artist's time. Like, for instance, at KCON, organizers were selling cheaply made merchandise for a chance to meet 101. I'm talking about things like banners, fans, and light sticks, things that no one was ever going to use. And the more you bought, the higher the chance you had, but there was no guarantee. So fans were lining up in droves to spend thousands of dollars on garbage. Even after feeling uncomfortable about that experience, I still went to 101 concerts and spent a ton of money buying random, useless stuff to get into fan events. That's what you do when you're addicted. You lose control. Then in 2018, I moved back to Korea for family reasons. Later, I got a job working for a K-pop radio program. I was like, sweet, I'll get to see K-pop idols all the time. And I did, and it was totally cool for a while. I'd walk in the building, and literally, Super Junior would be in the elevator. Remember I said I liked them in high school? Yeah, well, they're in the elevator. Another perk was getting tickets to TV shows where K-pop acts promote their latest music. At the end of the show, all the different groups come out on stage and they announce the number one artist of the week to congratulate them. There was one week where all the artists came out at the end and the whole stage was bright and pink. Everybody's cheering the winner. And I realize all the young people are just props for the grown-ups, and the goal is to make huge amounts of money off of them. And I'm one of those people who's making a living from these kids. It reminded me very much of a puppet show. It's hard to reconcile that kind of experience with also being a fan and a consumer. Now that I knew how the sausage was made, I couldn't help but feel icky about what I was buying. Being a fan started to become not very fun. And there were some truly miserable moments, especially as I attended more 101 concerts all over Asia. But the experience that really took the cake was in Malaysia. I think the event company overbooked the show. Thousands of people were trapped in these two standing sections that were not meant for that many people. It's hot and humid, and even before the show begins, I'm looking around at all these petite Malaysian teens and women who already look like they're gonna faint. Then boom, the music starts, and the fans in the back start pushing. People in the front who were already squished to the max are now passing out. I'm near the front row, screaming my head off for help. I make eye contact with one of the 101 members, and I remember seeing this horrified look on his face. They stop the show. The band is now asking people to please be safe. But then these girls who are on the verge of passing out, they were screaming not to be taken out. Like, no, please let me stay. They didn't want to miss the chance to see their idols. The funny thing is, the event company still carried out this extra meet and greet event after the concert. You'd think they'd have shut the whole thing down, but no. These idols were products and we were going to consume them as scheduled because money had been paid for their services. They still had to smile, look cute, and do the whole K-pop idol thing. I was still excited to see them up close, but when I finally did, I saw that they were exhausted and horrified. I think I said to them, "Are you okay?" It was clear to me that they weren't. Even if there isn't a disaster like this one, it's common for K-pop idols to be overworked. They tour constantly. They sign contracts with companies that invest a ton of money in them from when they're really young. The companies control everything about the artists' lives, including what they eat, who their friends are, where they go to school. But only a fraction of these idols make it big, or even make enough money to break even. Some of them end up with mountains of debt to the companies they sign on with. Some artists end up struggling with mental health issues. At least three high-profile K-pop idols have died by suicide in recent years. Others make the news for different reasons, by being involved in crime. The charges and convictions range from DUIs, drug use, tax evasion, and even sexual assault. Those stories really got to me when I was working for the K-pop radio show. Part of idolizing something requires that you take the human out of it. But if you're in the industry, you're forced to see the human side of K-pop, which meant I couldn't stay a willing customer. It took some time to give up being a fan, though. It helped that my favorite group, 101, had a natural end. They disbanded in January 2019 when their contract ended. I went to the final concert, mostly for my own closure. And then there was a revelation this year that the votes and rankings for the entire Produce 101 franchise were rigged. The show's top producer, An Junyoung, ended up going to prison. To think that the thing you were so addicted to was a fraud, that ought to sober you up. I still love K-pop in all its glory. The catchy music, the dance routines, and the flashy music videos. And it'll always be that thing that connects me to my culture. But you can love something without letting it change you. there are people out there who are counting on you to lose control and turn over your bank accounts, like I did.
Yoo Hyung Jung is a data journalist living in Hawaii. She's also a musician and scored some of the music in this story. Our lead producer for this week's show is Katherine Miskowski. She had help this week from Ike Sriskandaraja, and Taki Telenidis edited the show. Thanks to Reveal's Andy Donahue, Sue Oh, and Melissa Lewis. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy the Great Mustafa. Score and sound designed by the dynamic duo Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help today from Amita Ganatra, Stephen Rescon, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our interim CEO is Annie Schabel. Sumi Agarwal is our interim editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerato, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, there is always more to the story. From PRX.